The scripture reading this morning is from Exodus 9:1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord, the God of Hebrews, let my people go, that they may serve me.'"
Good evening, church. Hey, looks like we got everything working tonight. This is good. This is good. We're trying out some new stuff at our disposal. I thank you for your patience. I want to give a real thank you to Jim, who is up there in the crow's nest, slaving tirelessly at random hours to get all of the new stuff that we have working together. It's not easy, and sometimes when you're replacing one piece of a system that's been in place for a while, it doesn't communicate well with the other older pieces, and so we've been running into a little bit of that. And I just get random texts at random hours of the night. I'm over here. I've got a couple questions. Can you come over? So he's put in a lot of time. So thank you, Jim. And we appreciate everything that you're doing. How's everybody feeling tonight? You guys are not as cranky as I expected. Don't you know there's a game going on in 15 minutes? And I haven't delivered a 15-minute short sermon since you've known me? This was a real gamble. Yeah, I like your optimism, right? Yeah. You guys are the cream of the crop, right? Yeah, you'll be here no matter what. This is Super Bowl Sunday, and I'm going to try and do a rapid-fire, appropriately themed lesson. And I wanted to do something that might be a little bit of fun and bring us a little bit of good stuff to take away, too. So this is Super Bowl Sunday, and even though the Vikings aren't playing tonight, I'm still in a good mood. I love it. It's no surprise to me at this point, 33 years in. You just kind of get used to the way things are going to be. But I've been involved in sports for as long as I can remember. A lot of you have, too. I love them. I've played ever since I can remember being alive, or when I wasn't playing, I was watching Dad play. And so athletic competition for me, like some of you, maybe many of you, is kind of just a part of who I am. And so you notice me slipping in and out of these weird metaphors just without even thinking about it all the time. I've been forever constantly drawing random sports analogies, and they may or may not have brought any value to you. And if you're here tonight and they haven't been bringing value to you, I'm sorry. Because this is going to be one big sports analogy. I have an endless amount of useless statistical knowledge. So when the opportunity comes to talk on Super Bowl Sunday in the evening, I said, yes, finally these people will understand me. That may or may not be true. But then the topic, the question was, okay, how do we do a lesson that is pertinent and not just a throwaway because you want to talk about sports? What are we going to talk about that isn't just passing metaphor and analogy? The only athletic thing I can really think of in the scripture, I mean, there are a couple. Carrying crosses takes some feat of athleticism. We talked about that this morning. Jonah ran, but he didn't really run. He was kind of on a boat, so I could take that. And then I thought, you know, Moses had to be pretty athletic because he straight up killed a guy and then sprinted and escaped through the wilderness. But I got to thinking about that, and I was like, you know what, let's think about Moses. His entire story, actually, and specifically what happens through the Exodus account is exactly what I'm looking for. Moses is part of that Hebrew Hall of Fame, the Hall of Faith that we find, right? One of the most iconic and prolific biblical athletes, spiritual athletes that we could ever talk about. He's what we would call a first ballot Hall of Famer. You know, Moses gets in on his first eligible year. There's some excellent things we can learn from Moses. There are also some things we can learn about the team that he was working with and how God kind of developed Moses, because he didn't start out being a Hall of Famer, but he was molded into this blue chip prospect, this team captain, this mouthpiece, this great leader that took his team to the Promised Land. Now, this is a long story, and you might be thinking, okay, Marcus, 15 minutes and the whole story of Moses? Yeah, right. I'm going to just confess to you. I'm going to let you know where these things happen. We're going to read a little bit of it, but you're going to have to move fast tonight, okay? We're going to speed. There's already like 37 pizzas in the back getting cold, and there are cranky people with cold pizzas, so we got to go, okay? Let's begin. This is what I like to call... This is God Bowl. Oh, goodness. No. Oh, all right. You wait. Oh. okay, we're just going to go. I promised there were really cool visuals coming, and it was going to make this seem a lot better than it probably actually is. So we're just going to have to actually go through, okay? So let's start with the beginning of this story in Moses on our God Bowl topic. I like to call this the basket birth, and that's a shameless pun from the sport of basketball. Exodus chapter 2 and verses 1 through 4, we find Moses being born into a less than ideal situation with all of the Hebrew children. Nope, still out. I'm just going to keep trying randomly, so something's going to happen at some point. He's born into a basket. He is born and tucked away, floated down the Nile, picked up by an Egyptian woman of great renown and power and influence and privilege, and therefore he doesn't suffer the fate as many of the other Hebrew boys do. And we find out that Moses has begun his life in a situation that no other Hebrew child has had the chance to begin his life as. Okay? He's under the tutelage of the masters. In chapter 2 and verses 5 through 10, we read about how the daughter of Pharaoh was the one who came down to take him, and that he lived there in with Pharaoh's daughter in the palace, and he was taught and reared up, nursed there, schooled in all of the great sciences and arts of the Egyptians. And this is the predominant, not only military power, but scientific power and economic power on the planet at the time. He rises up in this environment, but as he comes of age, and as we know the story goes, and becomes aware of who he is and the plight of his people, in chapter 2, verse 11, it says, one day when Moses had grown up, he went to his people, the Hebrews, and he observed them being mistreated. And here's the athletic feat that we talked about before. But in light of the nature of this topic and evening, I'm going to call it a technical foul. I'm going to call it a personal foul. I'm going to call it unnecessary roughness. I'm going to say Moses got ejected with a life suspension from Egypt after he kills an Egyptian guard who's mistreating and abusing one of his Hebrew brothers. This is manslaughter. If you want to read how that goes, that's chapter 2, verses 11 through 15. Now, something interesting happens after that. After Moses has to leave, we're not there yet, guys. The children of Israel are still there in bondage in Egypt, and it's not a good time. Later on in chapter 2, beginning in verses 23 through 25, we read about just how bad things are. And it says, during the days when Pharaoh stopped being nice to them, they were in slavery and they groaned to the Lord. They said they cried out for help in verse 23. A cry of rescue from the slavery came up to God. And God heard their groaning in verse 24, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham. These children of Israel right now can do nothing for themselves. They are in a bad situation, and finally they have cried out to God. God remembers his promise. If we could put a sports metaphor analogy on the children of Israel right now in this contest, they would be the Bad News Bears. They don't have a leader. They don't have military experience. They don't have weapons. Now they're not going to have straw to bake to make their bricks. They're just there slaving and building monuments for another nation that is taking advantage of the fact that they grew into a very large workforce right under their noses, and a passive, peaceful one at that. So we have the Bad News Bear Israelites, and we have the Egyptians domineering in their power over them. But God heard the cry. It says that God heard and remembered his promise, and then we re-encounter Moses after he's been gone out in a far land, after sprinting away. In chapter 3, verse 1, and we actually read this account all the way through the fourth chapter around verse 17, God goes on a recruiting trip to find his guy. He goes to call Moses off the bench. He goes to get Moses, who was tending a flock, the flock of his father-in-law, priest of Midian. He goes to get him, and essentially he's making a recruiting trip for this gem prospect who will quite literally be the one who's going to lead his team from bondage to a place of privilege in the promised land. Moses was not ready to come into his own yet, was he? If I could liken Moses to an athlete, he's the kid who grew up with great tutors. His parents paid to send him to camp. He had private training, but he never had real game experience. He practiced, and he'd never put it to use. And this means for as skilled as Moses actually was, which would be revealed over time, he was actually quite raw. He was afraid. He was timid. And he was actually full of excuses as to why he couldn't be the guy. So if we read along between chapters 3 and 4, we find him raising concerns to God about why God has the wrong guy. But God is the master GM, and at every turn he has an answer. And even more importantly, God has a game plan. Because Moses is going to say to God, well, who do I tell them sent me? And God says, I am. There's not a much more definitive answer than that. And then Moses would say, well, what if they don't believe me? And then God told Moses all the signs that he was going to be able to show him. He said, well, hey, Moses, what's in your hand? Well, throw it down. It'll turn into a snake. You'll do this in the presence of Pharaoh. Well, but God, I don't think, oh, well, hey, Moses, what's on your hand? Put it in your cloak. Take it back out. Leprosy. Put it back in. Take it back out. Clean. Do this in the presence of Pharaoh. And strike the Nile, and it will turn to blood, and Pharaoh will be forced to grant you audience and hear what you have to say. He will harden his heart, but he will hear you. And then Moses said, okay, that's all really well and good, but coach, I can't speak well. And for the first time in the conversation, now Moses thinks he's a stutterer. And God has an answer for that too, and saying, well, listen, Aaron's going to be your mouthpiece. We all need an enforcer. This is funny because every good team needs an enforcer, a heavy, someone who can do the bullying. I introduced Katrina to Bill Lambier for the first time 2 nights ago. Who knows who Bill Lambier is? One person? Okay, let's... What, two? Oh, she remembered. Do you like Bill Lambier? Oh, yeah. Any Celtics fans in here? No, they're not willing to raise their hand now. Arch nemesis of the Celtics, Bill Laimbeer and his combat basketball, just the guy who was going to enforce and be angry. Aaron's the mouthpiece. He's the one who's going to talk. He's kind of like less offensive Dennis Rodman of the Israelites. When Aaron shows up, things get done, and he means business. He's your blind side. Has anyone seen the movie The Blind Side? He's your Michael. He's your right tackle. He's the one protecting Moses. He's the muscle. So Moses has spent his entire life training for a task he didn't even recognize. And that's kind of a lesson for us too. Many of us have spent our entire life living experiences, and some of them bad and painful that we felt like we had to run from and start over again. And they really have been preparing us for a task that God is going to call us to. And when he calls us to it, you know what we're prone to do? But God, I know I can't talk good. What am I going to do? Rest assured that God has a similar plan for each and every one of us in the same place. In chapter 4, verses 27 through 31, we read this. The Lord said to Aaron, go into the wilderness, meet Moses. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words that the Lord which had sent him to speak and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. And Moses and Aaron went and gathered together all the elders of the people of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses and the signs in the sight of the people. And the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had visited the people of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, they bowed their heads and worshiped. So the team captains are in town now, and they gather the elders of the tribes. And now we are setting the stage for an epic throwdown, one that has been told again and again and again. And there are a couple places along the way that I'm going to hopefully be able to prove that this is actually a really good sports-themed analogy coming on here, okay? It was time for Moses to get in the game. Moses has reluctantly accepted his post as the team captain, and he has gathered the elders of the tribes, and he is letting his power forward, Aaron, do the talking. And now starts the biggest underdog story, maybe in the history of the world. On paper, this isn't a matchup that's going to favor the Israelites, is it? I mean, there are still documentary after documentary that go up seemingly by the day about just how much grandeur ancient Egypt was, just how powerful they were, just how advanced they were, and all the things that they were able to accomplish. And now begins one of the bids for the most unlikely upsets in history of the world. This is Egypt versus the upstart sons of Jacob. And what can only be described as, let my people go. After that, we have all of the plague warfare that happens. And so if we had a little bit more time, I might ask you guys to tell me what are the top 10 plagues that can strike a team. But I've got a list here. Here's some of the top 10 plagues that can stop a team from victory. Scorching heat, that is definitely one. If you get the injury bug, you're in big trouble. Both teams tonight are healthy, by the way. You could have bad referees. That's usually the one we really want to blame it on, bad refs. I wonder if Pharaoh was looking at his magicians like, come on, ref. You're not doing your job. Bad coaching can be a big one. Also a plague upon your organization is if you have Jerry Jones as your owner. Having bad attitudes in your locker room could be a terrible plague on your team. Cramps can come to get you when the water source is low. Having a losing attitude, if someone has a really bad batch of pregame lasagna, that can certainly stymie any kind of victory efforts. And you could also have the Browns front office in control. All of these things are plagues on winners. There's no way that this works. But Moses and the Israelites have a secret weapon. Who knows the secret weapon? This is the easy one. This little thing in the back pocket called Yahweh, Jehovah God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he is, at this point, really a secret the world over. But he's not going to be a secret much longer. But Lamar Jackson's the MVP of the NFL this year. People knew who he was, but now everybody knows who he is. This is the coming out party for God on the world stage. This is the coming out party that we would be reading about in Deuteronomy and Joshua, how all of the people in the region are looking and thinking, we saw what happened in Egypt, and we don't want any part of what this God is going to do. This really kicks off beginning in... After the plagues finish, actually, it really comes to a head in chapter 13 and 14 after the children of Israel have gone. And basically what happens, if we're just going to summarize what happened through those plagues, God has, through Moses and Aaron, led the Israelites to an improbable performance. You guys have seen this before. It might happen in tonight's game. You've been there where a team that is an underdog on paper has gotten out to an improbable lead. In the first half, they come out and they shock the team that's the heavy favorite. What generally happens after that? You see it all the time in college football. The depth of the roster just isn't there in the second half. The coaches make adjustments on the other side, and you realize why they're paid much more than the smaller coach. And you realize that this team is not going to probably be able to pull off what has happened. There's a situation like this brewing. You see, what has happened is... every single one of the Egyptian gods has been confronted by Yahweh in these plagues, and they've all taken L's, one after the other. And at the end of the 10th plague and the death of the firstborn, we find the final encounter coming between Pharaoh himself, who believes himself a god king, versus Yahweh and Moses and the children of Israel. So, we could paint this by saying, the children of Israel have the lead at halftime. And they go into the locker room with any upset bid, and the heavy favorite is going to answer the wake-up call. After the shock of the repeated blows rained down on them by Jehovah in the form of 10 plagues, the Egyptians are actually going to rally enough that it is going to kind of unnerve the Israelites. Now, without a doubt, I picture this, and this is just because I'm weird. I picture Pharaoh letting the children of Israel go, going into his locker room, looking at his dejected team and his magicians and all of his captains, and then giving a rousing halftime speech. I just imagine, I was going to make David get painted in gold and eyeliner and record this, but I can't help but thinking that as he's watching the Israelites trail off into the distance, he just starts going off. You ever seen one of those halftime speeches when a team that should be winning just didn't show up to play? And I just imagine Pharaoh going off in there. I just imagine looking at his guys like, there is no way. I am a God king. Let these stinky little Hebrews run off with all of our gold. I'm a God king. I am a God. They think they can come in our house and humiliate us in front of our gods. No. No, no, no. They don't get to pillage Egypt. And then he issues the charge command, and the military of the nation of Egypt comes out of the locker room like demons possessed, and they go to chase down the Hebrews. Israel, on the other hand, may have been jubilant in leaving, but they've got this gold and they're free and they've battled the bully and they're in the clear, but they got to be thinking, can we really do this? Have you ever been part of a team where you're winning and you didn't expect to be? I mean, you said that you could and you believed that you could, but then, man, I don't know. Those guys are fast and they're big and they just keep coming and we hit shots that we didn't think we were going to hit. Have you been there? I think this is where Israel is. Is it really possible? Can we actually win? This scene with the Red Sea crashing down onto the Egyptians reminds me of the last second ticking off the clock in a game that is won at the last minute. Almost like miracle. But this is where there was lots of stuff going on and scriptures and stuff. It's not there. So you just have to pretend it's 1956 and you're watching the Exodus movie for the first time because the water's coming in right now. And this is how I know that this is appropriate. Because the time ticks off the clock. The final showdown between Pharaoh and Yahweh has happened at the Red Sea, at the crossing. The Hebrews have gone through on dry land, and then the waves come in and swallow up the army of the enemy. And I don't know what your favorite sports film is, but you know what always happens right after the big victory? You know, after Rocky knocks out Drago, then you gotta listen to Eye of the Tiger, and it's gonna be stuck in your head for the next 7 days till you don't wanna hear it anymore. And after the Titans win, you're gonna be singing, ain't no mountain high, ain't no valley low. Yeah, and you're gonna be singing that song. After every great victory, there's always an anthem. And if you go right after the Red Sea crossing in Exodus chapter 14 to Exodus chapter 15, guess what there is? An anthem. It is quite literally the song of Moses. As the last seconds tick off the clock in the God Bowl, when Pharaoh is defeated, when all the host of Egypt is defeated, when God's coming out party is finished, the first thing we do on the banks on the other side is sing a powerful anthem. It's a little different from "We are the champions of the world," but quite literally, that would be appropriate. It's kind of Moses' way of saying that. God is the champion of the world. No time for chariots, my friend. We are the champions of the world. I look at this from top to bottom, and I see why a lot of our culture is obsessed with sports. I don't think that we ought to be. But I think that sometimes in sports, we find those principles and those parallels in our lives that are hard to explain any other way. And I think in those moments, it inspires us to think about things on a bigger scale. And not everybody is like me and can look at the encounter of the Exodus from top to bottom and see an epic marathon of a sports contest playing out. But I think that the... there it is. I told you it was coming. We'll get it worked out, I promise. But the principles in play, the fact that Moses was born into a specific situation, the fact that Moses grew up in a specific way of life, and that things seemed to go totally off the rails, and God went and found him, brought him back, and gave him a job that would ever or forever change the course of history for the world, not just geopolitically and economically and militarily, but the fact that we are here tonight talking about it, the fact that through the work of Moses later the Messiah would come and God would call all nations back to himself is evidence that these principles are not just biblical principles, they're not just sports principles, they're God principles, they are life principles. And there are folks that are here tonight, no matter who you're rooting for, San Francisco or Kansas City, it doesn't really matter. You were born in a specific circumstance, just like Moses. You grew up in a specific place, just like Moses. And there have been times in your life where you had to turn and run and everything went off the rails. But just like Moses was being prepared in the wilderness, you were being prepared too. And maybe it is the fact that God has already come to get you and given you a job, and you figured out what you are here for and the part that you're supposed to play and what role on this team of gods that you have. And maybe you haven't figured that out yet, but I can promise you it's coming. And biblically, I can tell you no matter what excuses you have, God finds a way to keep knocking them down. And what I think is really cool about this, there's so much foreshadowing. Later, Paul would refer to what happens to the children of Israel in the Red Sea as a baptism. And it is a like figure to our own baptism when we become Christians and we kind of cross over from one side to the other. And I also think it's appropriate that we always find ourselves singing right as somebody makes that decision to join the winning team from one side to the other. Moses got to sing a victory anthem when the children of Israel finished their work, when God, when Yahweh finished his work against all the gods of Egypt. And it's kind of neat that in our own way, we get to sing a victory anthem just like that every time someone becomes a Christian. We're going to sing an anthem right now, a little bit different. It's coming. We're going to sing one right now. And that opportunity to cross over from certain loss to victory exists for every one of us. And for those of us who just haven't figured out what role we're supposed to play yet, pay attention and keep your eyes open, because God always comes to get his man. If we can serve you in any way, please come as we stand and sing.